Welcome back in everyone to a fabulous new Whisper in the Wings from Stage Whisper. We are bringing you an incredible piece of theater, an incredibly timely, powerful, provocative, important. I could go on and on about this piece, but it is truly fabulous. And here to talk to us about it today, we have the director, Jordana De La Cruz, and the playwright, Kristen Eve Cato. They are here to talk to us about their work, OK, which was most recently part of the 2024 Pipeline Festival at the WP Theater. And this piece, I mean, we left the theater, continue to talk about it. We've been bringing it up in discussions regarding this very hot topic, as well as just referencing the powerful point of view that it presents. But I am not the right person to be telling us more about this. Of course, that lies with our guest. So let's welcome on our guest, Jordana, Kristen. Welcome to Whisper in the Wings from Stage Whisper.
Hello.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
I'm so happy you're both here. I am living for the conversation we've already begun to have, especially, I mean, as it relates to this piece that the two of you have your fingerprints all over. It was such a powerful show, and it was only in a festival. This was like a presentation of a quote stage reading, but I was ready to see it move elsewhere. It's so good. So Kristen, why don't we start with you as the playwright? Can you tell us a little bit about what OK is about?
So OK is it's a story about these three women are in the show, and one non-binary person who identifies as all genders, who is our lovely stage manager. And these people are from New York City, and they're in Oklahoma, a small town called Guthrie, Oklahoma. And I'm sorry to anybody who's from there. So they're there doing this regional production of a bilingual adaptation of Oklahoma, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma. And they're doing it in Oklahoma, and it's a non-union production. And, you know, the circumstances, and they're not so great, but they're on tour, and it's post-pandemic, it's 2022. You know, shortly after the shutdown. This is when people are just starting to get back into the theater. And yeah, they're out there doing the show, and it's all sold out, a sold out run. And these Argentinian producers from New York City are, you know, they're the ones running the show, so to speak. And so there's that dynamic happening. And then one of the performers, the lead who plays Lori, well, her name is Melinda in the show, but she plays Lori from Oklahoma. And, you know, she finds out while she's on tour that she's pregnant, and she, you know, she takes action. She sets up an appointment, which took her weeks to make, because in Oklahoma, I think there's like just a handful or few of where there were just a couple of abortion clinics. And so, you know, they make her go through this whole process. And so it took her weeks to get this appointment. But it's the summer of 2022. And Roe versus Wade, you know, it's now all at the power of the states, and they cancel abortions, right? Because the governor of Oklahoma just signed the bill making abortion legal as soon as they reversed Roe v. Wade. So nobody had a chance to do anything. And then Melinda, at the top of the show, because remember, this takes place inside of a dressing room. And this is the top of their call time to their show. So they have like 90 minutes. And she gets a phone call. And the phone call is, you know, this woman who is canceling her abortion appointment. And so she's like, holy crap, what am I going to do now? And so, yeah, it's a story about these three women who are at odds with the world, external world around them. And they're just trying to survive and navigate this post-Roe America, and trying to see how they can help out their friend Melinda, because she has to do the show or she has to leave, essentially, because the only other place she can go to is New York City now.
That is a fantastic, and as I keep saying, powerful, powerful tale. I think this is one of those stories that we ignore about. And I absolutely was, I loved, and I also had a chuckle at the fact that it was in Oklahoma, but it was like a bilingual Oklahoma. And I was like, I mean, that would be a cool production, but Oklahoma, like in Oklahoma, like, all right.
I mean, when you think about it, it's like, all right, let's think about that time in Oklahoma. Like, there were definitely, like, you know, Black cowboys, Mexican cowboys, and, you know, Native indigenous cowboys, you know what I mean? So it's like, yeah, that was Oklahoma. I mean, it was the land, the time of the land runs and the land rush and the gold rush and all these things happening, and like the all these boom cities and boom towns just popping up out of everywhere. So it's like, you know, when you reimagine what that, you know, what Oklahoma must have been at the time of, you know, that this musical is set in, the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, you know, it's like, well, of course there was a Mexican somewhere in there.
Yeah. It wasn't all white people out there singing and churning butter. But yeah, I love this piece. And I think it's, again, one that should be taught, one that needs to be done now more than ever, because this is a timely issue. How crazy is it that we live, in theory, the freest country in the world, and yet you could travel, you know, 1,000 miles or even 500 miles and you're in a new state where you've lost rights. How, like, it really makes you kind of go, what?
Yeah, well, for what Kato and I were really, something that was really relevant is that people in New York don't necessarily know. So like, even like me and my friend group don't actually know how close those states are that this is happening with. We always just think of like, things like this are happening in Texas, and then we kind of move on with our lives.
Yes.
But that's actually not the case at all. There's so many other places that are closer to us, so many other places. And that's something that in like our liberal bubble here in New York City, it's easy to forget about.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, like, but I do wanna like add something to you know, this topic that we're talking about right now, which has to do a lot with the show too, is that what I think something that we kind of skip over in our minds because we're so wrapped up in the injustice of it all and the, you know, the questions and the protests and the political debates and the religious debates, that we forget about the woman who just woke up and like the rights she had yesterday no longer apply to her today. How that shit happened overnight.
Yeah.
In most states, especially Oklahoma. I mean, and granted, like, these states have been, you know, doing lots of things to make abortion really hard to get. You know, it's not something brand new that women were waking up to. But the absolute, like, right just completely legally taken away.
And in the script, you definitely do that. You make sure that we see that and know that from it being, like, a New Yorker, from it being one of us being there.
Right.
And their life completely changes as well.
Right. Right. And that's why these women are from New York City, you know, a place where they're like, oh, like, you know, we're just so used to our lifestyle. That's why I placed them in Oklahoma, because I think that we don't have to worry about those things as much from here. And the thing is that this issue, we should worry about. We shouldn't be like, oh, we're in New York, we're fine.
Yes,
definitely.
I want to trudge on a little bit, because I mean, it may be an obvious answer, but what inspired you to write this piece?
When I saw the governor sign the bill on national television, making a whole spectacle out of it. And then it was also around the time that there was actually the Oklahoma Revival on tour. And so it was just like, Oklahoma was everywhere. Like at this stage, at this like moment in my life, I was watching everything and staying, you know, watching all the coverage news about what was happening with the Supreme Court and their decisions in the states. And I was really involved in it because this is something I feel very strongly about. I am an advocate for women's rights and especially reproductive rights. And so, Yeah, I was just completely disgusted by it. Like, you know, he's signing the bill on national television, and like this law is just gonna, like, you know, ruin so many lives, and he's just making a spectacle out of it. Like, it's just some sort of celebration and like milestone achievement of his whole entire career. And then like at the same time, there's this revival, the musical, like the revival of Oklahoma, and it's like touring everywhere and people are attending and it's selling out and there's so many reviews about it. And granted, I think it was a great production, but we're still doing this production, you know? And then I thought about my own relationship to this musical, Oklahoma. So when I was in middle school, we had this theater program, and one of the first productions I've ever done as a kid was Oklahoma. And this is in the Bronx, by the way. Let me just paint that picture. So we're in the Bronx and we're doing Oklahoma. And of course, my wonderful drama teacher made lots of edits. And, you know, we didn't do the entire show. We did the safe kid version of it. And, but yeah, that was my introduction to that musical. But, and although it's a great memory, it just goes to show how, like, these misogynistic and racist and sexist shows that are so revered all over America and that touch people's hearts, like, they're still relevant and they're still like making impressions on young children and people growing up. And it's just like, well, can't we just change the narrative about this? Or like, you know, how do we continue celebrating these shows that have shaped the culture of, you know, the cultural fabric of American theater? It's like, how do we take these old existing shows that are so inherently problematic and reclaim them in a way, right? Because I feel like we can't just toss them in the garbage can. That's not what theater people do. We don't burn books, we don't burn plays, we don't burn musicals, but we do have to acknowledge the truth about what they are and the time they were written and when and how and who. And so, yeah, so that's, and then in high school, fast forward, I went to LaGuardia High School for Music and Art, and I was a vocal major. And I remember it's my sophomore year, and for voice class, we were studying character songs, like musical theater character songs. And one of the songs that was given to me was I Can't Say No. And I remember, you know, this, I'm like 15, and, or actually like 14, turning 15. I was like youngin'. I remember looking at these lyrics because, you know, this is character songs, right? So it's interpretation of the lyrics, interpretation of the character. These are, you know, this is all the homework you have to do, like, you know, while you're in school and studying songs, and you go to voice class the next day and you just show off all the homework you did, right? So as I'm doing homework on my song, I'm realizing, like, this is rapey. You know, like, I don't really identify with this song. And I'm 14 going on 15, and this just feels not right for me to sing. But it was the assignment. So, you know, I did the assignment, got the assignment, aced the assignment. But it left an impression on me. I remember feeling, you know, like, and I also think I was the only girl in the class that was handed that song. Maybe there was another student in my class. But yeah, I just remember thinking, this is problematic. And so fast forward, I'm watching The Governor, and I'm looking at these reviews of this revival, and I'm thinking, this is going to affect so many women, and the women who it's going to affect the most are women who are like me. And that's where the story came out of.
Wow. First of all, brilliantly put. I love the points of views as I've mentioned, and the ideas represented in the story, but also in the inspiration behind it. I think that's brilliant.
Thank you.
Now, Jordana, I want to bring you in. I'd love to know, how is it you came upon this piece?
So Akito and I are both part of the WP Theater Labs. So essentially, it's a two-year program where there's five producers, five playwrights, and five directors. And at about a year into the program, a year and a half into the program, we express who we're really excited about working with, and then they pair us up. And so Kristen and I got paired together. And I was so excited because all I knew was that, like, I liked this person, I liked this playwright, but had no idea what I was going to be given script-wise. So that's how it works. You're just given a script by the playwright and you go from there.
That is amazing. I love that. I love how you two have come together. Oh, I love it. So Jordana, kind of building on that, what was it like developing this piece?
Developing this piece, it was very exciting. It was very, I don't know, I kind of want to use the word hot, in that there was just like things were just changing and Kato was in the room and lines are changing and actors are expressing themselves and designers are there and everything was so quick because we had 2 weeks. So we had 2 weeks to create this production. Note for, and this is an entire script, this is a full length play. And so everything was just kind of like quick and fiery. But the thing is, the content is deep and the content is not easy things to speak about in terms of women's rights and abortion and miscarriages and just all of those topics. But what was really great was that in the play, Kato writes in these tarot cards that come to life. And so the tarot cards that come to life bring in so much joy and laughter and such that you don't get bogged down by the weight of the play that talks about serious issues. And so you have this outlet to just laugh and let go. So then you're even more accepting of the stories of these women on stage. And so that was very exciting in terms of the rehearsal process.
That is very awesome. Kristen, coming back to you for this next question, I would love to know, is there a message or a thought you are hoping audiences take away from this piece?
I want audiences to, I think the main thing I wanted to talk about, the central theme that I needed people to really grab onto is this idea that it doesn't matter where you fall on the spectrum, whether, because I think, you know, there is this spectrum. It's not black and white. It's not this polarizing thing that, you know, politicians and religious leaders have brainwashed us to believe it is. I think the idea of abortion is absolutely, you know, complex and it's a spectrum. Some people, you know, are pro-choice, but personally, they would, you know, they don't believe in it for themselves, or they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't get an abortion for whatever reason. And, you know, and then there's some people who are absolutely, you know, gung-ho pro-choice, and they're just like, yeah, I had, you know, six abortions in my life. You know what I mean? Like, and then there's people who are just like completely against it, but will support someone who needs it, right? And so, and then there's like the far end of the other spectrum where it's the other far end of the spectrum where it's just like, no, it's evil. You're all evil. You know, you're going to hell, right? So it's like, you can believe all those things. You are entitled to believe all those things. You know, you have your own mind, you have your own thoughts, and you have your own body. And just like you are in, just like how everyone should be in control of their own thoughts and their own minds and their own bodies, it's the same concept. So it's like, no matter where you fall on this spectrum of, you know, pro-choice and pro-life, the bottom line is you can't make it illegal. You just can't.
Yes, say that again for the people in the back. Absolutely. Jordana, coming to you for the final question of this first part, I would love to know, who do you hope have access to this work?
That's a great question. I would love this work to be free of charge for everyone, but being realistic, I think it could be programmed somewhere, produced somewhere, and for a reasonable cost, but then it can go to really women's shelters that the show could go to, high schools that the show could go to, community centers. So essentially, we want everyone that this show affects to be able to see it. And the thing is, it affects everyone. it does affect high school students. It does affect us in theater world. It does affect us in professional world. And so we want to make sure that it's accessible to everyone of all ages. I think that's a big thing too. It's not a show just for like in your 30s and abortion, or even in your 20s. There's people having sex in their teens, and they should know about everything that involves. I just also just thought of, we'd really like that to be accessible for men, for specifically cis men, because it's not just a women's issue. It's women's bodies, but they have a lot of say in it. As Cato made very clear, they have so much say in it. And so it's important that they know what's going on, that they know where and what and why is happening, and that they are able to speak up.
Totally. I want to piggyback on that, because absolutely, like, we need some male allies and accomplices in this fight. Men cannot be neutral right now, because you know what, these are your mothers and sisters and wives and daughters that we're talking about.
Yeah, I aunties. Think people don't... yeah, no, it's like, I think a lot of people, they don't remember that. They just think about it as it applies to like their girlfriend or something like that, but they don't think about their daughter, they don't think about their sister. They just make, they choose what a woman is, and then they make it all women.
Interview. We love giving our listeners a chance to get to know our guests a little bit better. Pull the curtain back, if you will. And I want to jump straight to my favorite question to ask guests. And that, of course, is, what is your favorite theater memory?
Maybe when Cato talks, something will spark another thought. But right now, I'd say a favorite memory, maybe not the favorite, but a favorite that I've been thinking about for a while now, is that in 2021, in fall 2021, multidisciplinary artist and composer Justin Hicks had a show called Crossover, and it was at Jack in Brooklyn. And it was a song cycle, and it was the first show I went to post one of the quarantine shutdown periods of the pandemic. There were times that, you know, we were open, we were closed, as a theater community. But this was a time where people really were going to see shows. They were going in smaller groups. There was masks, there was 6 feet separation, but we were getting into the space. And this was my first theater experience. There was about 30 of us in the space. And Justin Hicks would be singing to us about a song cycle from his memories of growing up in a Baptist church and his experience in love of R&B at clubs. And these texts and readings in response to those. And it was just so intimate. And I think it's the most intimate show I've ever been at. Just have a small group of us. And he's sitting at the piano in the center of us. We're sitting on the floor and just talking. And a lot of people, I think, wouldn't consider that theater. It'd be like, oh, this person is singing songs and talking to people. But like, that is a version of theater. That is a version of performance of art. And it's one that I've really been trying to get back to ever since we opened our doors again, post the pandemic is not over, but post a quarantine period.
I love that memory. Thank you so much for sharing that. Kristen, what about you?
All right. I have a lot too. And there's three of them that are just really hard to choose from right now. So I'm just going to shoot through all three and I'll, you know, bam, bam, bam. So the first one was, I was at the first ever Encuentro Festival at the Los Angeles Theater Center. This is like back in 2014. And it was a huge theater festival. And it was like it was a Latinx, you know, playwright. I mean, not playwrights. It was just a Latinx festival. And LATC, you know, is this... it's this building that there's like four theaters in there. I think there's like five, including like a gallery space and a black box. So maybe there's like five or six. I mean, that experience in and of itself was just monumental. But it was in that festival where I saw one of my favorite plays, which is Water by the Spoonful by Kiara Alegría Hudes.
That's one of my favorite plays too.
That play changed my life. So I saw a production of that play. It was part of the festival, but it was a Puerto Rican, like from Puerto Rico, production company, cast, all like the whole team came from Puerto Rico, flew over to LA to do this show, and it was all in Spanish. And I had never heard this play in Spanish, never. And I mean, the cast was phenomenal, you know, like, first of all. So the play is great. The actors were great. But then hearing it in Spanish, it was so gorgeous. And I remember in that moment sitting there and I was just like, wow, like, there's just so many things that we can't say in English that we could say in Spanish. But then I just remember but like the interpretation of it sort of kind of changes, you know, when you change when you translate it. But it still had this universal thing. It still had this, like, it still pulled at my heartstrings. It still was so, it was just as impactful as it is in English. But I think hearing it in Spanish really resonated with me because I'm like, this story is about, you know, a Latino family. And when it's performed all in Spanish, it really hits home. It really hits home in a way where it's like, oh yeah, I've heard these conversations happen before. I remember being little and, you know, my grandparents and my mom and my aunts, so we get together and talk and you know, I'm little and I'm walking around. I always like being around the adults, and I'm sitting at the table trying to just, like, you know, be a part of the gossip. And, you know, they would code switch. They would start talking in Spanish in front of me, to, like, you know, I guess when they were saying things that they didn't want me to hear, but I knew Spanish. I'm like maybe, and that's the thing about people who are raised in a multilingual home. It's like, you know, the linguistics is so interesting like that, because I may not have been talking fluently in Spanish at that young age, but I definitely understood it. So anyway, that was just a side note. But yeah, but like, you know, they were having these really deep conversations that, of course, they'd want children to hear. But, you know, I grew up listening to those conversations in Spanish, like the ones that you don't want the kids to hear. And so, I mean, I just made many connections to that, to, you know, hearing that play performed in Spanish. And it was just life-changing for me. And the second one I want to say is, it's actually one of my own experiences being in a play. And, well, it was my play. I was a playwright in it, but it was like wasn't post-pandemic. It was like during pandemic. But in Tartt Theater, they were like, let's keep theater alive. And they created a series called Micro Teatro, which is this micro theater, which is, you know, these short plays, but they're site specific. And, you know, in charge has got about six playwrights together, six teams of, like, you know, of a playwright, three actors and a director. And they gave us these places around the neighborhood. And, you know, Intar is located, you know, on the far west side, on, like, you know, 52nd Street, like between 10th and 11th Avenue. So, you know, it's a historical neighborhood. It's a neighborhood with a lot of history. It's a neighborhood that is constantly changing, and it's Hell's Kitchen, you know? So it's like participating, because I was also a participator. I went to my other, you know, colleague shows, and because you can do like a whole day of it, right? Because all of these micro shows are just 10 minutes long, and they're like in site specific area. They are site specific, like, you know, like in, but they're all in the neighborhood, because the point of the festival was to, like, you know, yes, keep theater alive, but also keep these places alive, keep these places open. Let's do little plays in these places, and then people know that they're there. So it was like a community effort. It was like theater and neighborhood and like people in the community and just like everyone just getting together during this really crazy, scary time, you know? And it was a very profound experience, because people had been just so like, it was well attended. I mean, like, we reached the outreach for this, I mean, went beyond, like, you know, INTAR's, you know, subscription list. Like, I feel like people were just yearning and for this kind of connection. I mean, this is 2021 still. You know, this is like, we're all masked up and only like 5 to 10 people at a time can come into each, you know, site-specific place and hear this wonderful 10-minute play written by some crazy dope playwright and directed by these like amazing directors, and just like, and it was all like, you know, INTAR actors, which, you know, INTAR actors, they're versatile, they're passionate and they're raw. And so it's like, you know, it is really raw talent that you get out of INTAR. And so it was that was just one of my favorite ones. And I mean, like, yeah, my favorite pandemic theater moment. And then the third one, and this is not like, not in particular order, and this is certainly not like my top five. I mean, these are my top five, but there's so many more freaking favorite memories. But this one was my first TYA play. It's called Jelly Beans. And it was during my second year of graduate school in the MFA program at IU. And, you know, it was our Playwrights Festival, and it was the workshop production of my play Jelly Beans. And I wanted to do TYA. I did TYA, and I don't know what really, I think because I took a TYA class and then I started writing this play, and then I loved it so much, and then I just took off with it, because it was very deep to me, because it's about these kids who are just trying to deal with their father's death. And like, one kid is building this like app on his phone that can sync to your brain and can see your memories, because his dad died when he was so young that he doesn't remember his dad as much. He doesn't have many memories. So he wants to infiltrate like his sister's memories, his mom's memories. Like, he wants to see his dad through those memories. So his sister, you know, she was a little older when their dad passed. And so she has memories of dad that she doesn't want to keep, because dad died from cancer, and it was a very debilitating thing. And you know, he basically just withered away in front of her. And so she sinks onto like her brother's new techie savvy app, and she gets trapped inside of her brain. But then she starts trying to find ways to delete the memories that hurt her the most. And even though this was a kid's play, you know, it's something that adults often wish for too. Like, how many times you just wish, ah, I wish I can just delete that memory. Like, I just never want to have that memory in my head ever again, you know? And so it turned into a family play, you know, and not so much as like just a theater for like, you know, children and young audiences. It was a family play, and families went to this. And I remember seeing all the kids, and kids are like the most honest audience members. Like, when they're bored, you know, they're bored. If they don't like it, they're very vocal about it. If, you know, like, you know what you're getting when kids are in your audience. And this was a moment. So seeing all these kids in the audience and seeing their families and seeing these children and completely engaged. And you know, I'm the type of person, I like kids a lot. So like, I go up to all these kids, you know, randomly one by one, and I'm like, oh, hey, I'm the playwright. Like, I wrote this play. Like, did you like it? Like, I remember asking like all the kids who was hanging around afterwards, because their parents were hanging around, and I would just like engage with them and have conversations with them. And this one little girl, she had shared with me that her father had just passed. Like, and at this time, it was just like, it had been only a month, you know? Like, it was like a recent past, it was recent death. And she told me, she was like, I really related to your play because, you know, my dad died not too long ago. And it made me feel like I'm not the only one. And that is just something I continue carrying with me.
Those are amazing memories. Thank you both for sharing those. Well, as we wrap things up, I would love to know if our listeners would like more information about OK or about either of you. Maybe they'd like to reach out to you. How can they do so?
They can reach out to me via email. I'm not on all social medias. I'm just on Instagram and Facebook. But I'm on, you know, I'm pretty, of course, I correspond, you know, not right away, but within a day, I'll get back to you. But yeah, I think if they want to reach out to me, definitely through social media, via email. And, you know, this is, OK is something that is so topical and so important, and it's so, it needs to be done right now, that I'm just like, y'all, hit me up if you want to read this.
Yeah, and for me, email is best. My email is JordanaDLC, like Jordana De La Cruz, @gmail.com. If you're interested in talking and working with me, in speaking with students, I've been working with students, I've been working with other playwrights, directors, and I would love to, wherever this play goes, I want to be there, and I care so much about it. And so if you have any ideas for me and Cato, ways to develop further, then please, please, please do not be shy. Even if you're not sure, just send an email.
Yes, second that.
Wonderful. Well, Jordana, Kristen, thank you both so much for taking the time to speak with me, sharing this incredible piece of theater that needs to be continued to be produced. It is so important. It needs to be produced everywhere, not just here in New York, everywhere. And for
everywhere.
Sure, amazing.
Everywhere.
This was so wonderful. So thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you for speaking
thank
with us.
You.
This was a blast.
Yeah, I had a good time.
My guests today have been the director Jordana De La Cruz and the playwright Kristen Eve Cato, who joined us to talk about their work, OK, which most recently played as part of the 2024 Pipeline Festival at the WP Theater and is ready and raring to go for a production. So if you're out there, you need to get your hands on this, reach out to our guests and make this happen. This is such a powerful piece of theater. We have some contact information for our guests, which we'll be posting on our episode description, as well as on our social media posts. But if you have the chance to see a production of OK, if you're interested in producing the show, hit them up because this show was amazing. So until next time, I'm Andrew Cortez, reminding you to turn off your cell phones, unwrap your candies,
and keep talking about the theater
in a stage whisper.
Thank you.
If you like what you hear, please leave a 5-star review, like, and subscribe.
You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Stage Whisper Pod.
And feel free to reach out to us with your comments and personal stories at stagewhisperpod@gmail.com.
And be sure to check out our website for all things Stage Whisper and theater. You'll be able to find merchandise, tours, tickets, and more. Simply visit stagewhisperpod.com. Our theme song is Maniac by Jazzar. Other music on this episode provided by Jazzar and Billy Murray. You can also become a patron of our show by logging on to patreon.com/stagewhisperpod. There you will find all the information about our backstage pass as well as our tip jar. Thank you so much for your generosity. We could not do this show without you.